Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 725. Let's go to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. You're out there doing stuff. I'm making it happen, living your dreams. All right, I gotta set that to music. The Osseo Theater, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. If I'm not, I'm a dick. It's a small art house and independent theater in Monterey, California. Northern California. Monterey has the Monterey Bay Aquarium. It's one of the best aquariums in the country. Monterey is a fantastic town, and I can't believe that there's a small art house theater there. It's a good community. It's like a cool community there. They got to support this shit. So they recently had financial troubles. Locals were devastated. And it's the only theater of its kind in the area. But three former employees are trying to save the theater. So they set up a Kickstarter to raise money in hopes to open it back up. So please go to Kickstarter.com and search OSIO to find it. Unless they... You know, what if the money was just mismanaged and it's because they were trying to build an art house theater that would rival the aquarium? This is like a full aquarium art house theater. It's just all aquarium plays, all aquarium movies. But let's just give them the benefit of the doubt. So help them out if you can, or don't if you hate the arts. It is entirely your prerogative. I am not your judge, you son of a bitch. But I am also going to be doing Stand Up on the Fun Comfortable Tour coming up in Texas. Got a run in Houston, Dallas, Austin the second week of September. And then the following weekend will be in Buffalo and then Toronto for Just for Laughs. Tons more dates piling up. Go to funcomfortabletour.com. This episode is Sir Patrick Stewart, who is literally one of the raddest human beings. He was on the podcast maybe like 4 years ago. I went to Wizard World in Chicago, and I moderated a panel with him that they let me record and put out as a podcast. And so he was gorilla style on the podcast. He knew he was going to be on the podcast. I didn't trick him, but it just wasn't an official podcast. Really fun episode, though. But this one, Patrick Stewart is one of the coolest, funniest people that you could ever hang out with. And Matt Myra was there, and Matt barely spoke. It was also Matt's birthday that day that we recorded this a few weeks ago. Aw, happy late birthday, Matty Myra. But Patrick Stewart, incredible individual, has a great new show. It's called Blunt Talk, Saturdays at 9 p.m. on Starz. Stars with a Z for the kids. But the show's really funny, and I predict that you will thoroughly enjoy this episode because I enjoyed the shit out of doing it. So, Patrick Stewart, thank you for being awesome. And now here's Nerdist Podcast number 725 with Sir Patrick Stewart. Katie, engage the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Are you a little chilly?
No, not chilly. Not chilly, but just a little cool.
It is a little brisk in this room. This room is haunted with the spirits of 100 years of film and television making.
It looks like it.
It is.
Couldn't afford plaster, eh?
No, not on a podcast budget, but it's
There was a couple of days where Will Wheaton was going to come because Will's one of my oldest and dearest friends. And then he got ill, and he begged me to tell you that he adores you, and he's sorry that he couldn't be here.
He's full of shit.
Finally, someone is brave enough to say it.
Yeah, I always knew he was. Even when he was 12, I knew he was full of shit. I just can't get used to the fact that he's a middle-aged man.
With grown kids and a beard.
No sense, that. And a beard, yeah.
Yeah.
And a bit of a belly. Well, he has. At least he had the last time I saw him.
Hey, by the way, you still look the same. It's amazing.
Yep.
What's
know the secret?
What's the secret?
Well, I say you want to know it. I'm not going to tell you.
Oh, shit.
I was just confirming that you wanted to know it.
You get the satisfaction of knowing that I would love to know the secret.
Yeah. Well, clean living,
mm-hmm.
healthy thoughts,
mm-hmm.
Eating very little, not drinking at all.
Yeah.
At all. Thinking good thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of yoga.
Yoga?
Yeah. A little bit of Feldenkrais. A little bit of... what's that thing where they pull the string up on your head?
Oh.
Alexander technique.
Uh-huh.
All those things. That's what contributes to my uneerily youthful appearance.
You may not be human, in fact.
Well, the fact is, I think something happened.
What?
I don't know. Something like Rip Van Winkle, like.
With you?
I'm 75.
I know. You look amazing. This is Matt. He's also on the podcast.
Hi, Matt.
Hello, sir. How are you? I'm going to sit here and be quiet.
Just so everyone knows, Matt's not late. We just started a couple minutes early.
Thank God.
So I don't want people to think.
I need people to know. I'm punctual for the most part.
Matt's very punctual. I was just telling Sir Pat Stew that he has looked exactly the same for decades, and he was saying clean living, healthy mm-hmm. thoughts. Yoga is some exercise.
Did you do some upper body training for First Contact? Because you look pretty cut in that when you're swinging around engineering.
First Contact?
Yeah, when you're fighting the Borg in engineering, you have to swing from the ropes. That's the second Star Trek movie that you're in.
That was 20 years ago.
Yeah, I know, but you looked great.
I mean, I can't remember breakfast.
You were in a series called Star Trek.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, The Next Generation. It wasn't the original one. It was the next one.
Really? There's more than one?
You were great in it, too. A lot of people watched it. Yeah, yeah.
Boy. And that must have been during my gap years.
Oh, you mean when you were on the weekends on the gap? Folding khakis.
No, I do nothing.
wait, what? You just gave us a whole bullshit?
Yeah. Yeah. A little bullshit now and again. Did nobody any harm.
Because I watched the first episode of Blunt Talk.
Oh, did you?
And there's a scene, and I don't want to give too much away, but there's a scene where you're shirtless and being whipped. And you look great. I'm not kidding. You look, like, fantastic. And it's not even like, he looks great for 75. You look great.
Thank you.
So
we want to tell you how good you look for an hour. That's what this podcast is.
Wonderful.
I mean, look at those. Look at that posture and those forearms and the calf muscles.
No, I don't know. I think I have peasant genes.
All right.
You sold those during the gap years, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nicely done.
Quite nicely done.
Yeah.
It was a little obvious, I thought. I thought we were going for more subtlety.
What? You're the master of the quadruple take.
I have a feeling that either my parents lied to me or I fell asleep.
Yeah.
The Rip Van Winkle theory. And in some sort of, perfect preservation. Like when guys, eventually when they go to Mars, they're going to go in some cryogenic state.
Right.
Well, I think I was in that.
Yeah.
For a big period of time. And it could have been largely during the Star Trek years,
mm-hmm.
because I have no recollection of them at all. None.
That's actually not surprising from the standpoint of, you guys are probably shooting most of the year. You're getting pages day before. You're doing it, forgetting about it immediately, doing it again the next day. I mean, of course, it's all performers, especially in a television show like that, you live entirely in your short-term memory.
Entirely. I mean, 24 hours sometimes. And, you know, we would sometimes wrap a show early in the day. We never ran over into another day. But we might finish at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But instead of saying, you know what, you guys go home. You've worked really hard. Have an early night, 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. We'll start the new episode. Oh, no, that never happened. No, the director would close up his script, walk off the set, be replaced by another director. Okay, hi, everybody. Here we are. So, first scene. And we will begin shooting the next episode.
Holy shit, really?
Are you surprised it's all a blur?
No,
it's
not
amazing, though.
Even if you had regular, normal days, I would think it would be a blur.
That makes so much sense, though, because they don't have to put up a new set. Everyone's still in the right costume.
Yeah.
So they can just bring in someone else.
Yeah. Just you need the new director.
Wow.
And, you know, the only things that stand out are those occasions when we used to mess with the directors, especially a new one. And we had, in the later seasons, we had a lot of new directors for some. I guess the old ones were sick of us. And so we would play little games with them, you know, like telling them that we would only say the lines in the script if he rolled the camera, but we didn't rehearse. And
you're like fucking with a substitute teacher.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it felt like. My personal contribution to that was first day of shooting with a new director. We come back after lunch and start a new scene. You'd say, okay, Patrick, so you're in the captain's chair at the beginning. Jonathan, you come in. Then, Patrick, will you go up and you'll meet him down at the bottom of the horseshoe? Oh, no, I'd say. Oh, God. And I'd turn to the AD and say, here's another one who hasn't been told. What do I have to do to get this across? I'm so sorry. I'm really sorry. It's the front office. They should have told you. I don't do standing up acting after lunch. And the guy would say, what? I say, no, I only do sitting down acting in the afternoons. And he'd say, really? I say, yeah, I'm sorry you didn't know. And you would see all his shots beginning to dissolve, you know, all the careful plotting that he'd done. And he's thinking, how do I shoot all these scenes with this guy sitting down? He's got to move from A to B, you know. It passed the time.
I know, but you have such an incredible...
I wish Captain Picard had that. Like, I'm not standing up before news, so he got beamed everywhere.
I couldn't tell if Picard had a huge sense of humor. Do you think he would have fucked with people?
Yeah, for sure.
Really?
Right?
No, he didn't. You see, he was a little tiresome and boring in that respect. He didn't. Riker made jokes.
Sure.
Even Data, who wasn't human, made jokes.
Mm-hmm.
He was programmed for jokes. You know that?
Right.
Captain Picard, he never thought in that twisted way out of which humor occurs at all. I don't recall saying one funny thing in 7 years and 178 episodes.
Oh, wow. But you see the great part. So you have this incredible power, which is when people see you or they work with you, they think that, well, now because of social media, people know that you're fun and funny, but you could hide behind the I'm a Shakespearean actor, and then people get intimidated, and that's the perfect time to knock them off balance and screw them.
Absolutely, as Seth MacFarlane has discovered.
Oh, he's one of the EPs on Blunt Talk.
He is, yeah. The original concept was Seth's, and he came to me, and I said, are you crazy? Of course, I'd love to do a half a sitcom. Not sitcom, it's not a sitcom.
No,
it's not remotely a
sitcom. It's a single camera, yeah. Show.
Yeah, and people keep coming in.
Yeah, I know. This is busy shit going on here, Patrick. We got stuff happening.
No, she brought coffee.
It's a chai latte.
Somebody else brought water.
Yeah, do you want anything?
Somebody brought in a furry bag.
It's a Chewbacca.
Yeah.
This is a Chewbacca notebook.
Oh, really?
Yeah. See, he's not. Sometimes he'll.
And they told me I was coming to an adult show.
Oh, I'm afraid you were misinformed. Beep, 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 beep.
Misled. No, not much of a sense of humor. And of course, the good Professor Xavier, not a laugh in him.
No, not a funny guy at all. He's been peering into people's thoughts for too long. His brain is too... He's seen too many horrible things.
Yeah, and people keep asking me, wouldn't you like to be able to read people's thoughts like Professor Xavier? I say, fuck no. I mean, it's bad enough having to be with people. But to know what they're thinking as well, impossible.
For real.
No, I just... slash my wrist in a warm bath. So, having gone that far, we've got another 55 minutes to go.
Remember to go down the river, not across the stream.
But I don't know if you remember this, because I'm sure you've done a million.
I've met you before.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I remember.
You do?
Yeah, I can't remember the circumstances.
The circumstances were...
Was it that sauna?
That was the second time.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
that was the second time. Where are my underpants? But we met at I moderated a panel at a Wizard World in Chicago, and your son was on the panel too. And and it was really fun, and we had a really good time. And it was a podcast. We recorded it, and it was actually the first time you were technically on the podcast. But it was like 4 years ago.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the convention circuit must be a complete blur.
Mostly, except for the reunion aspect of it.
Right. Mm.
That's a great appeal. Just getting together with those people I adore.
And you mean like meeting me again after all these years?
No,
okay.
Not at all.
All right, good.
No, I'm meaning Jonathan and Brent, LeVar and Michael and Marina and Gates when she shows up. And who's the little guy? The little young guy who's now old?
Will Wheaton.
Yes.
Will Wheaton. One L.
Of course, he was too young to go to conventions when he started work with us, I think. I think they have a minimum age.
You know, I was friends with him when he was doing Star Trek. So we were friends that long, and I remember, and you know, he just rejected the whole, you know, the whole sort of like, I don't want to be an actor. He just kind of like stomped around the set sometimes. It was adorable.
He was. I liked him very, very much, and I loved the work we did together. We had a couple of episodes when it was just him and me. We were down on some alien world. In a cavern. Mm-hmm. But then that could have been one of many episodes. and I was injured, and he had to care for me, and then we were rescued. And so 47 minutes passed. But he was good company, and he took his work very seriously.
Yeah.
He didn't screw about much. I mean, for a, what was he, 14?
I think he was probably around 14 when he started, and you know, I think it was in like 14 to 18 or 19, maybe.
Season 3, he became an ensign, and then season 4.
Okay, walk us through the timeline.
Oh,
season
no.
5 is the first.
No.
Season 5.
Why did he have to 3-9. Come in?
Season 5 is first duty where he comes back. So that episode was in season 4.
Okay, name the second episode of season 6.
Oh, I can't. I'm not that good. Oh,
he's pretty good, though.
What a dis... No.
Well, the first episode is Time's Arrow Part 2. That's the first episode of Season 6.
Uh-oh.
And then Season 6... Episode 2.
Matt had this special code called Alpha 3-9 that you would immediately beam you out of any situation where someone cornered you and started naming episodes.
Yeah, anything awkward. It would be a thing that on the Enterprise you would come in handy if you were awkwardly walked into a situation where, like, Frakes is fighting with Marina or something like that. You'd hit the button, you'd say Alpha 3-9, and it would automatically transport you back to your quarters.
Oh.
And you wouldn't have to deal with
that. That'd be pretty good,
anymore.
Right?
That would be great.
See?
That would be something like my Fart Finder app.
Yeah?
You've read about that.
No, please explain the Fart Finder.
You've read about it. Thank God somebody here follows me on Twitter.
Well, Kyle likes you and farts at the same time, so he got it from both ends.
How did I know that? He got it from both ends.
He got it from both ends. Yeah, exactly. Precisely. Well played. Gates McFadden almost hit my car the other day.
With a fist?
Yeah, with
she's
a flying
scary.
Kick. With a roundhouse
you know,
kick.
She's a black belt.
She's...
Yeah, yeah.
She was... apparently...
That's all she wears.
That's
just,
all,
a
just a
black belt.
It was very awkward. Put some clothes on. You're in public. But apparently we're neighbors. She lives just right around the corner from me. And
someone was trying to turn around. We live on narrow streets, and someone was trying to turn around, and my car was parked on the street. And she came, and I came out right as she was just about to back into it. I was like, no, wait. And then I look, and she rolls the window down. And she was like, hi, I'm sorry. I'm Gates McFadden. And I was like, oh, my God. And then it totally made everything fine.
Crash into my car. Crash into my car, please.
Will you please sign
the crash?
And then
would you sign it? Yeah.
I mean, there's even – Brent is in the – Brent's got a little nod in the in Blunt Talk. He's in it for like a second.
He appears in 3 episodes.
How many episodes did you guys do?
10.
You did 10 episodes, and it's on Stars. It's going to be on Stars.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Let's talk about it a little bit. Yeah, we'll drift in and out.
Star Trek. Ah, yeah.
Let's talk about Stars Trek.
Yes.
God damn it.
Well, my personal trek in this has been initially led by Seth. Mm-hmm. That's as in McFarlane.
Yep.
10 years ago, thereabouts, he came and offered me this role in this new animated series, American Dad, mm-hmm. which the 11th season is, I think, running now.
Unbelievable.
And that was the beginning of this world of fun that I had never really inhabited before. And I got roles in Family Guy, and I play Susie the baby in Family Guy, who's too young to speak. But she thinks aloud in my voice. She's an infant, you know.
Yeah.
And then Ted, 1, 2, Million Ways to Die in the West, all of that. And then 2.5 years ago, he came to me and said, how would you feel about a half-hour live-action comedy show? And I said, who would I be? And he said, well, you'd be a British journalist working with a weekly news, cable news show every weekday night. And he's got a kind of crazy life. How would you feel about that? And I said, yeah, I'm in. Sign me up. And that was the end of the conversation. And then we talked about baseball or singing or something.
Baseball or singing. Just one of those two things.
Yeah.
One of those two unrelated things.
He's a big baseball fan, you know.
And he loves singing, too.
And he's a huge Star Trek fan. Sorry, I didn't mean to go.
No,
there.
It's.
But he is.
Don't apologize to Matt.
I think actually originally he only cast me in American Dad so that he could be nearer Star Trek.
Do you think that's what happened?
Something like that. It was so he good. Actually, you know, because he's pretty well one of the big guys in this town now with what he's done. When we were shooting, I was having a little reunion dinner one night with Brent and Michael Dorn and Jonathan. And I think LeVar was there too. And he came in to the restaurant and saw the table. And I swear to God, he began trembling, you know, like my God. And he looked around and he couldn't believe that there were these guys. It was perfectly clear what was wrong with him. So we invited him to have dinner with us, and he sat down, and he sat like, you know, a teenager on the edge of his seat, looking from face to face, not believing that he was sitting there. It was charming. And then it got boring. It got tiresome.
It got tiresome.
And we slapped him around a bit.
Of course.
And that's what I think led to Blunt Talk being what it is. So we've shot the first season, mm-hmm. 10 episodes. We air on Saturday, the 22nd of August, mm-hmm. on Stars.
Yes, with a Z.
With a Z.
Zed. You're in America now. That knighthood don't mean shit over here, son. Where's America?
Well, will you please then tell people to stop calling me Sir Stuart?
Yes.
Only in America. America.
America.
Do they call me Sir Stuart? And I want to say, actually, if you want to use my title, it's Sir Patrick. Yes, Sir Stuart. I know. No, Sir Patrick.
Why
is it so hard? It's because you don't have those kind of honors here.
No, we have Kardashians.
Closest we get is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Is one of them running for the Republican nomination?
One of the Kardashians?
Yeah,
well.
I thought I saw one in the lineup the other night.
Disguised as Ted Cruz.
That was Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz is actually a Kardashian.
It wasn't. Oh, he's actually. Yeah. He kind of shapeshifts.
He shapeshifts, yeah. Could be Trump. I think there's a Kardashian living in his hair.
He'll be speaking one night, and the Cruz, the C, will fall away, revealing a K.
I am victorious. Yeah.
Tomorrow night, I don't know when is this? Tomorrow night is going to be. They're all going to be on there.
They're all going to be on there.
I can't wait.
I know.
I mean, could there be a bigger indictment of the Republican Party than that? Donald Trump is a front runner.
Well, I think you know the thing about Trump, and we keep going back to this, and it's
you're a fan.
Such a huge fan of
I like mirrored gold windows on buildings as much as the next guy.
Yeah. I love eating horse shit, so I should probably put that out there too. I think what's so funny about it is that he's in a realm where he just doesn't give a shit, and everyone else gives so much of a shit, and that's really entertaining to watch.
Yeah, I mean, let's have an entertainer in the White House.
Well, I don't.
I mean, we had Ronald Reagan.
We did. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we.
We had the Bushes. That was entertaining.
I think it's funny for the debates. I think at a certain point, if he gets closer, people are going to be like, "Oh fuck, I don't know if this is funny anymore.
Yeah.
This may not be entertaining."
How would he be sitting down with Putin?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. If our State of the Unions and stuff is like, so I told that country to suck my dick. Whoa, please, Mr. President. Like, it's going to be the craziest.
You know, you're right. It would be funny for a few months.
Right.
And then it would be ghastly. and all of a sudden, America was the second country in the world and not the first.
Right.
Why are you so obsessed with being number one? Can you explain that to me?
Well, I don't know if I speak for all of America.
Come on, speak
for America.
Damn it.
Because of ranch dressing and NASCAR and Honey Boo Boo. The end. I think it's because Americans are geographically allowed to be somewhat up our own asses because, you know, over in Europe, there's so much culture in such a small space. And, you know, we experience that to a degree. Certainly, you know, coastally, New York,
there's Canada.
Canada
there's
also.
Mexico.
There's Mexico also.
And you have borders there.
We do.
We don't cross them.
Yeah.
Well, not legally.
But I think it's just we're sort of like we're in this kind of like weird landlocked narcissism where we kind of – because America's so big. It's just so big, you know? There's not even really one identity to it.
Well, that's true. I've been traveling around America, and I've been in most of the corners of the United States. Not a lot in the middle.
Right.
But all around the perimeter. And my feeling quickly became one of not understanding how this country can be governable.
Right.
Because it's so many countries.
Yeah.
I remember landing in Lafayette, Louisiana once. For an afternoon, I was meeting with a girlfriend who was a writer, and she was doing research in Lafayette. And I promise you, I felt that I was on another continent. I couldn't understand a sodding word anybody said to me. Not a word. The landscaping was weird and strange. All these trees were strange, and there was water and, like, you know, alligators crawling down Main Street and everything was weird except for the food, which was sensational.
Amazing food, yeah.
Oh, I love that Louisiana food.
Yeah.
But I got on the plane to leave. I was only there for a few hours. And I was flying back to California. And it felt like I should have been showing my passport when I left.
Right.
I really – and of course, that's just the place. The people, too, are so different. How you can combine under one nation is a miracle.
It is actually pretty it's incredible. It's an incredible feat and something that, you know, I just always wonder, like, long term, someday some people are going to start breaking off.
Well, I mean, Texas wants
they
to
tried
do
to do
it.
It. Texas tried to do it.
They'll have another go.
They'll have another go.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Northern and Southern California will split up at some point, I would imagine.
Well,
but.
Yeah.
And that means that Southern California will really dry up.
Oh, yeah.
There'll be nothing. Absolutely. Here.
Well, Southern California is always on the wrong end of a war with every other state that Southern California doesn't really understand or know how to participate in. But everywhere else you go, you're like, ugh, L.A., I bet that place sucks. You're like, well, I mean, you know, it's fine. There's nice parts to it. You just hang around nice people. It's like any city. Ah, place fucking sucks. People are shallow and shitty. What is wrong with you? I mean, it's like, is there any place like that in England that everyone just unilaterally shits all over?
Blackpool.
No, just kidding. Not at all. Essex. All right. that would pretty well match. When people ask me where I come from in England, I'm a Yorkshireman.
Okay.
And I say to them, where's it? Yorkshire? I mean, it's only the biggest county in the country.
I've been there.
You know, when are you going to start teaching children in American schools? By the way, this is Walter Blunt speaking.
Yeah.
This is not Patrick Stewart.
Okay.
International geography, world geography. Nobody knows where anything is.
No. Yep. No.
They just don't know.
All I know is that Salzburg is the capital of Australia, right? Did I get that right?
Yeah. It begins with C, the capital of Australia.
Canberra.
Canberra, there you go.
Yes.
You got it.
I knew. I was just making jokes.
Good job, Chris.
Thank you. I love England. I wish I had more time to go over there. It's just far enough away, and I don't ever get enough time off for
it's
me to
fabulous.
Go.
And London gets better every year. It was always a beautiful city, but now you can really enjoy how the city looks. The infrastructure is great. And finally, the continent has arrived.
Yeah.
So we have cafes outdoors, bars, pubs stay open.
That's where I'm
late.
Going on my honeymoon.
Oh, nice.
We're going to
you
London.
Are? London?
Yeah, Iceland and London.
Nice.
Where are you going first?
Iceland first, then London.
Okay, I think that's smart.
Yeah.
Then you can thaw out.
It's a stopover. You stop. You go to Reykjavik first.
We're going to Reykjavik because I want to try this restaurant called Dill. Uh-huh. That's supposed to be amazing.
You're going to Iceland in order to eat in a restaurant?
Well, I mean, we're going to be there for a few days, but that's one of the things I was like.
And to be man and wife and to.
Yeah, and then we're going to London, and we're gonna stay in London for a few days, 5 days, I think, like something like that. And then, you know, I just loved it so much when I was there last that I was like,
really?
We should go.
When Matt and his future wife are finally able to give their virginity to one another.
It's going
to
be great. I really hope I can perform the way that you're supposed to.
Well, I don't know about how you'll perform in Iceland. Believe me, the UK is a hot.
Yes. It's hot, actually.
Yeah, good stuff. And you'll be inspired by it.
I'm
motivated.
Big Ben.
We're going.
Big
finally,
Ben's plundered into the Thames.
I'm finally going to that to Gordon Ramsay's three Michelin starred restaurant.
I'm kind of curious what London is like if you are Patrick Stewart. Like, what parts of London? It almost feel like it'd be interesting to see a travel series where if you were someone that got to go places that not everyone necessarily gets to go. Like, what does that look like?
What do you mean?
I mean, there are places. There are like private clubs. There are places you could probably just go to the Palace if you wanted to.
It's called Parts Unknown with Anthony Bourdain.
No, but he's not going into the palaces. What kind of fun stuff do you? What's the secret London?
Well, there is a secret London. I have no part in it. It's because it would be full of young people.
Of course,
I think. And really, that's not my world.
Right.
I don't know. Because they're not old enough yet to have seen Star Trek and X-Men.
Right.
You know, they're that young. Where would you go? I mean, everywhere has private places, don't they? Where I stay away from are tourist areas.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about people on holiday where, and of course, there's nothing wrong in that, but they lose their inhibitions,
mm-hmm.
but they also lose their sense of good taste. So when you're a tourist, you can kind of get away with anything because you're on vacation. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And you can say, I know you. You're Dr. Spock from Star Wars, they will say, you know, across Regent Street. No. No one all counts to that question.
You just did the, you know, there's a real fun meme online that's designed just to screw around with nerds where it's a picture of you and the text says use the force Harry and it's attributed to Gandalf at the bottom.
Yeah, well, I don't delve in that magic shit.
Here,
you know, and Ian McKellen has this long staff, you know.
Yeah.
I did say to him, you know, you shouldn't have that staff. It looks like a prop. I don't mean a property.
Yeah.
It looks like something to hold you up, you know. And if you have something, don't stagger around for how many movies? Five movies.
Yeah.
Five movies. Six. 43 no. hours.
Yeah. on a stick. Actually, it sits, that stick sits in an umbrella stand inside his front door.
Oh, really?
You go and visit his house, and the first thing you can play with. And I use that phrase advisedly.
Well, then what's the second thing?
Gandalf's
it depends how well you do with the stand.
Oh, it's a test! It's a test! Everything's a test. The House of McKellen is a puzzle box.
He is one of my dearest friends.
He was just on a couple weeks ago.
On your show?
Sitting right where you're sitting.
Yeah. How was he?
He, you know.
Did he talk about me?
We did talk about you a little bit.
We touched on me.
We touched on you a little bit.
Where? Which part did you touch?
on the doll. I showed him on the Patrick Stewart doll. You know, we just sort of talked about you guys being friends and running around and being silly. And he said, you know, some of it, he was like, well, some of the stuff, you know, all the Taylor Swift stuff, we did that to promote the thing that we were doing. But we still have fun. I mean, it's nice that you guys are, I think people sort of live vicariously through the public facing side of your friendship, which is
you think
nice.
So?
I do.
I never thought of that. Maybe it's true. Well, you know, if those old guys with knighthoods can fool around like that, anybody can fool around. Is that what you mean?
I think so. Yeah. But also just
gives a kind of free pass.
I think there's something human and kind of like people who've been friends for a long time and just friends always, no matter where you are in your life, you're still just friends. And when you get together, you just fuck around with your friends. And that's really nice.
Yeah. Mentioning his house, it's really interesting. It's a little eccentric because right inside the front door is Gandalf's staff in an umbrella stand. And it was a couple of years ago when he's got a terrace with steps leads down to the river. And I saw these things on the steps, and I looked closer, and I saw they were all his awards.
Just on the steps?
Just and rusty and stained and kind of the wooden bits rotting and falling apart. All his awards, and there are many, are all out there. Now, I've heard of modesty. You know, you put your Academy Award in the bathroom.
Sure.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But I've never before encountered somebody who puts all their awards outdoors in the garden. I mean, mine are lined up in the hallways. The first thing you see.
Of course.
You come to my house.
There's a step and repeat where people have to take pictures.
No, he has many more than I do. He has many more of most things than I do.
You know, he was a little tricky. He was a little tricky at first because he doesn't like doing. Now, I don't think these are interviews. These are more conversations. But he doesn't like doing interviews. He said he doesn't like doing
it's
them.
True. It's true.
And he was a little walled off at first, but he completely warmed up. And it was really. If I had done this any less amount of time than I've done this, I would have gotten nervous. And I think think it wouldn't have gone the best way.
Sure.
But I just sort of like, you know, well, we'll just keep talking and it'll be fine. And he was fine. He was a lovely gentleman.
He's a prince.
How long have
Even though he's a knight, he's a prince.
Did you guys know? You're confusing my American brain. Were you guys friends before you guys worked together on X-Men?
No, we were not. I knew of Ian McKellen from the moment he became a professional actor.
Of course.
Ian was a star before he left university. He was at Cambridge. He went to a fancy school. And he was already – he'd been spotted when he was acting with the Drama Society at Cambridge. So he came out and pretty quickly he got good jobs and Olivier brought him into the National Theatre. And I saw his work. And it was amazing. Also, he was – and he still is. Gorgeous.
Oh.
You ever seen photographs?
I've seen old photographs of him, like the most dashing.
Oh, boy, he was beautiful. So on every respect, I was intimidated. His talent, the work that he got, his looks. I was bald at 19, and I thought certainly my romantic life was over as a result of that. Proved not to be quite.
Not quite true.
But then we worked together. We did the world premiere of a Tom Stoppard play, a very short Tom Stoppard play called Every Good Boy Deserves Favor, which isn't performed much because it needs a symphony orchestra.
Oh,
well.
Okay.
And that's kind of
expensive. They're pricey.
It's expensive.
Yeah.
EGBD, get it?
Yeah.
EGBDF. Yeah, even if you call it EGBDF, it's still expensive. And we had a couple of scenes, and he was lovely, and I liked him. And my intimidation, sense of intimidation grew less, but it didn't go away altogether. And then I saw his Macbeth, which was extraordinary. And then we were cast in X-Men. And the first movie was shot in Toronto. It was winter, deepest, darkest Canadian winter. Mm. And we had adjoining trailers. You know, there was this, at least there was then, I think it might have changed now, there was this kind of favored nations deal.
Sure.
Where we all got the same trailer.
The same thing, yeah. It's just easy that way. It's clean. Yeah.
And they were beautiful, too. Make no mistake. We were well looked after. I think Hugh Jackman now has 14 trailers. He has one trailer.
13 of them are for his weights.
For his weights.
Two are for each one. Each set of claws gets a trailer.
Another for his masseur. Food is prepared in one trailer and cooked in another trailer.
His abs get three trailers. Yeah,
exactly. His smile is polished in this trailer.
Of course.
And then he's got one trailer just to sing about.
And he works on his American accent in another
trailer. In another trailer, right.
Because he's Australian, did
he
you
is,
know?
Yes, of course.
Australia's most famous son. Thank you, Mel.
Yes. Oh.
Who's back?
Is he coming back? He's back?
He's directing again, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I know, it's kind of exciting. I want him back.
You ready for it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I did a movie once with him, and he was so much fun and so entertaining and so hardworking. And
I'm glad to hear that, because he got not fun for a while. He got not so fun for a while.
That's what I've read. Yeah, I'm aware of that. I didn't know him in those days, but this was a film with Julia Roberts and Mel were playing the two leads. And I was a guy who shuttled between both their lives. And they were both fabulous, but he was just adorable. Anyway, so we were in adjacent trailers. And you know, on movies like that, you do spend significantly more time in your trailer,
sure,
waiting to work than actually working. Was it Burt Lancaster who said, "They pay me for waiting, I do the acting for nothing"?
I'm going to say yes because I don't know any better.
I think it might have been.
No, that sounds correct.
That sounds correct.
And so we had these endless hours sitting and chatting and about all the friends we had in common and the work that we'd done and our love of Shakespeare and our upbringing. We're both Northerners. He's a Lancastrian. I'm a Yorkshireman. And that's when it all began and became something. And coupled with the fact that we were always the oldest two members of the cast.
Sure.
You know, and there were kids like Anna Paquin. And, yeah. You know.
Running around.
Yeah. So then we did this big show, and we did the Sam Beckett Waiting for Godot in London. And the two characters are on stage together for the entire show. And that's when – and we shared a dressing room. It was Ian's idea. It wasn't mine. He said, and this is absolutely brilliant and very typical of him, he said, "We can't do this play of these guys who have been together. There's a line in the play for over 50 years. We can't do this play every night by meeting on stage when we come on. We need to start the play an hour earlier in the dressing room."
That's
not
so
actually
nice
start it, just begin connecting.
Your chemistry.
Exactly. And he was so right. Though his habit of walking naked around the dressing room was at times...
arousing?
Intimidating.
Oh, I see you brought the staff from home. I mean, it's been 15... Did you start shooting in 99? You start shooting
what?
X-Men? X-Men.
Oh, God, I don't know.
It was probably... It must have been around 99, right?
It was, yeah. it was in another millennium.
It really was. It really was. But X-Men was a movie that really sort of brought comic book movies back from this weird place where they weren't amazing.
Yeah, because they were – the first one straight off was about something. And the genius of Bryan Singer was the opening scene of the very first movie.
And you were immediately hooked.
But it made you think, this is not a a comic book movie. We're in a concentration camp, and it's ghastly. And this kid is in desperation. Oh my God, he's making the gate move. You know, I just thought that was a wonderful way to set the tone that these stories are about something, and about something that in every corner of the world is really important, which is how do people get along? Mm-hmm. How do different people make contact, tolerate one another, support one another?
Mm-hmm. And these
we stayed there. You know, the movies stayed there in that place ever since, right up to Days of Future Past. Of course, they're now in the middle of shooting the next
Apocalypse
X-Men movie, which I am not in.
What the shit?
Nor is Ian in it.
What the double shit?
It's hubris, you know? I told Brian this. You think you can do it without us, eh? Well, we'll see. You know. We'll see. But I said, but also you should know, we're on standby.
It's a case.
Jennifer starts playing up, you know?
Yeah.
Fassbender starts playing up. You just pick up the phone and call.
So if Jennifer starts acting up, you're gonna play Mystique?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I am so ready.
You literally could,
to be
though.
Naked, painted blue. And the world is ready for it, too.
Absolutely ready for it. It's time. You need to take your chalice in the shape of your naked blue body.
Oh, chalice. Yes, right.
Yeah, so right. That's what
I misheard for a moment.
I'm so sorry. But it's also such a great story of those two characters who had the same thing, had a friendship. And the thing that I loved about the movie was that no one was flat out evil. You were arch nemesis by ideological default. You both had different ways of trying to fix this problem of discrimination. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And it was really one of the first times that it wasn't like, I'm the evil villain and this is my... It was like, this is how I see this is going and I was hurt and this is why.
Because Ian was the most reasonable villain. His arguments were calm and assured. Of course, that's always when they're the scariest.
Of course.
Aren't they? Was it the first one or the second one that ended up in the plastic prison?
That was the first one at the very end, yeah.
Yeah, which was a great way to end an epic comic book movie, is two older guys sitting playing chess in a plastic prison.
Yeah.
They'll do fine. The phone will
but
never ring.
You are here if.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. That's important.
I was actually on the set 2 weeks ago. And, you know, on those kind of movies, no cameras.
Right.
No selfies. No taking pictures of the cast. No, absolutely not. I mean, there are guards everywhere. This part, no. Unless your name is Brian Singer.
Right.
And then you can take pictures of everything and tweet them instantly.
Right.
You know.
But you can't.
No, not allowed. So he took a photograph. He had somebody take a photograph of him and me sitting on the set. And, of course, the word went out. And it was suddenly, but Professor Xavier is not in this movie. Why is Patrick Stewart on the set of X-Men? Well, I was just there to show moral support.
Or maybe that's how you got yourself cast in the next movie. Huh? See? Now he's got a...
You are so much nearer to the truth than
that. Oh, that would be amazing.
Yeah, we'll talk about that
Someone
next
has time. To replace Hugh Jackman.
Hugh has said he's retiring. He's hanging up his claws.
I got to say, you know, Wolverine in the last 15 years, because they... I moderated the X-Men panel at Comic-Con this year, and they showed his audition tape. He was audition tape, and he looks like a kid. I mean, it's not that he looks amazing
he
now,
was, yeah.
But he looks so much.
He was a skinny kid.
Skinny kid. And so seeing where Wolverine has just gone from a guy in good shape to like just looking ripped now, like he's. It's pretty remote. And he's a big guy. He's a much bigger guy than you think he's going
to
be.
Yeah, I think he's had some growth hormones. Because I swear to God, he was not that tall when I met him. He's kind of... Maybe he just wants standing up straight.
It's his posture. Well, the funny... So when Sir Ian was here... When Sir McKellen was here... It's America. When Ian was here, we had this long talk about here. He was saying, like, you know, when people want pictures in public and... You know, sometimes I wish they would just talk, you know, just like taking a picture. It's so meaningless. And we had this long conversation about trying to capture everything, you know, with selfies. And I had to admit to him, I was like, you know, I was totally going to do that after this podcast. But I'm not going to now because I'm just going to make this experience just for us. And he seemed to appreciate that. What I didn't tell him that was so embarrassing. See, here I thought, seeing you guys gallivanting around town, I thought, Well, Ian McKellen's he's a larf. He likes to screw around. It's going to be hilarious. So I had Kyle, our PA, but this is so embarrassing. I had him go to a costume shop and get that derby hat and a monocle and a mustache, and I was going to take a picture with him where I was doing like, oh, hello, and realized that if we hadn't covered that in the podcast, that would not have gone over great. Like when I see the how small the crevice of danger was, that it was like the one guy that I should not be doing, oh, let's do a pick. Like, it was really.
Wow. Right. I'm impressed.
But you realized it and saved yourself embarrassment. And, but, you know, I'm surprised he said that because he is so affable and cooperative. When we would come out of the stage door, I don't know, he always got out sooner, quicker than me.
Well,
and I would get out, and he would be having selfies with everybody out there, you know. And I would say, Ian, you don't have to do that. I don't do it. I just say, sorry, no, I'm off duty now. My work is done.
Yep.
No, I'll sign, shake your hand, say hello. But photographs, no. But he will do that, and he won't bitch and complain. And
well, guy, for people in your position, though, if you take one, it turns into 1,000.
That's
very quickly.
That's my line.
Yeah.
When in public places, like an airport or a hotel lobby or something, I have to say, I do one. You know, that's the rest of my afternoon gone.
Right.
And mostly people get it. People are great.
They are.
I'm still not used to it anyway, being asked for an autograph.
No, but still
weird to me.
Why do you think that is?
It's a kind of false modesty. I say these things to give the impression that I'm really kind of naive.
Have you been hanging around Chan Lee too much?
It is so exciting to meet me.
Actually, it is. I always get a kick out of saying, I always make a point if I see Stan of saying hello to him.
He's like 92 years old, and he's a legend, yeah. And he's so funny and sharp, and, you know, like, yeah. It's like seeing Stan Lee makes me go, you know what? It's going to be fine to be 92. You know, absolutely. like if it's like, look at him, because he's still super engaged and still running around and, you know, being funny as shit, really funny.
Okay, can I direct us in the supposed subject?
Do you want to talk about?
Shall we?
Yeah. So the Dune reboot, is that not what you were?
Isn't it funny? There's a lot of talk about Dune. I hear somebody else, and by somebody else, it's somebody really famous, is going to make a second go at Frank Herbert's novel.
Is that true?
I have no idea. Oh my God. I've read it, for sure. I mean, I thought David Lynch did a pretty amazing job of the first one.
It looked amazing.
But that was meant to be a franchise. We were supposed to do 3. How many Frank Herbert books are there? 5 or something. And we only did 1. That was my first shot at a franchise, because I believe you cannot have too many franchises.
You need as many as possible.
And and all the studios, we're all in agreement about it.
Listen, if Stuart comes over and he asks about franchises, tell him you don't know anything, because he's going to try to get into another fucking franchise. How many franchises? Like, you're the franchise king. There was one, and then and then we'll talk about Blunt Talk, but even though you're in it for a second, L.A. Story, it's such a wonderful.
Oh, how nice of you! That was such a lovely experience.
To kind of the fish.
3 days, if that, 2 days. It was just gorgeous.
Did Steve Martin just call and go, "Hey, I just have a little thing for you," or did you guys already know each other?
No. He didn't call. It must have come through my agent. But he was so lovely and attentive and carrying the whole weight. He was producer and lead actor. And I remember we were shooting downtown in an interior. Oh, the bank. We were shooting, you think, with a bank balance like this, you can have the duck, you can have a piece of bread and the salad. And he said, "What are you doing for lunch?" And I said, craft service, you know, in my trailer. He said, "No, come with me and Victoria, he was married to Victoria Tennant. And I had lunch with him. No director has ever asked me to go to lunch with him like that. I mean, I was impressed that doing, with all the responsibility he had, that he took a lunch break, but he did. Actually, it happened to me once before. The first time I ever saw a film camera, I have told this story once before, so I'm sorry.
All right, goddammit. Fine.
This is not an original story. I'm sorry. I was saving it for you, but
get ready,
else.
Listeners, for a non-exclusive.
First time I saw a film camera, I was sharing a scene with Rod Steiger.
Wow.
Who was one of my teenage heroes. All the time from The Pawnbroker and On the Waterfront, of course. And I couldn't believe that I got this little part in this movie with, which was all in the back of a car, with Rod Steiger sitting in the back of a car, in which I had to pull a gun on him. Now, you remember the scene in the car in On the Waterfront? I can tell by the look in your eyes. You don't know what the hell.
I know what you're talking about.
You are.
Of course.
When Steiger and Brando are in the back of the car.
It's a classic movie.
And Steiger pulls out and holds it in front of his brother Brando, and says, take the job, take the job. You know. Well, it was a moment. I was pulling a gun on Steiger. And anyway, we finished the morning's work. They'd done all the two shots outside the car, inside the car. They'd done Rod's coverage. And the assistant director said, okay, Rod, it's about 40 minutes to lunch. Why don't you go now and have your lunch? And we'll finish off here and then we'll rehearse the next scene after lunch. And Rod said, well, what about Patrick? You haven't covered him. He said, no, we're going to do that now. But somebody will read in your lines. Don't worry about it. And Steiger, who had been sitting down, very slowly stood up and said something along the lines of, who the fuck do you think I am? You think I'm going to walk off this stage and leave an actor here with you or some other buddy idiot reading in for him? What kind of actor? I mean, he was irate with fury, which is why I always do all my off-camera lines, no matter what. And I mean, this poor, I mean, he was... And Steiger in a rage. Well, you've seen him in a rage in the movies. He's terrifying. And there was apologies. So we did my coverage. And indeed, he sat there and fed me the lines. And when we finished, he said, what are you doing for lunch? And I said, you know, in the tent, craft service. I mean, I was nobody. And this was, I had like four lines in this movie. And he said, hey, when you got your lunch, bring it to my trailer. We'll have lunch together. So I got to take my lunch into his trailer. And somehow instinct told me, I can ask this guy anything. And perhaps he'll answer the questions. So I did. I said, in the scene in Pawnbroker, or in the scene in Waterfront, when you did this, I mean, real geek questions.
You're fanboying on him.
Yeah, that's right. Whatting?
Fanboying.
Oh, fanboying. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he answered everything. And of course, for me, it was my first day on a movie set, and I'm sitting in Rod Steiger's trailer. It was great.
Well, of course, and also that informs, that's such a valuable lesson, which I don't even know if he completely appreciated the magnitude of, which is that as you set down your career path, you never are going to forget that. And oh, no. That's essentially a legacy that he has passed down.
Absolutely.
Through you, that you would do the
Absolutely.
Same thing.
If you're the lead in a movie, you set the bar. And I've had leads now for years in plays, in TV movies, now in a TV series. And you are the standard of the work. You know your lines. You hit your marks. You're on time. You're not sitting in your trailer on the phone for half an hour while everybody's waiting for you. You take everybody into account all the time, because it's a cooperative, is filmmaking. And that first lesson was so vividly taught me by Mr. Steiger. Now, he may have been largely doing a lot of it for my benefit. It's very possible. But I'll tell you what, I didn't see him again for about 15 years. And I just come to live in L.A. and start Star Trek. And I was going to a screening, at the DGA one night. And I went into a restaurant very close by to get a drink. And as I was walking down the tables, I saw Steiger sitting with someone down there. And I thought, oh my God, God, there he is. Ah, no, I'm just going to leave him alone. Let him get on with his. As I was down halfway down the aisle, he stood up and said, Patrick,
oh,
how great to see you again. Damn it, he remembered my name. I mean, that's awesome behavior.
That is.
I don't know your name. What is it again?
It's Chris.
Chris, right. Are you sure? Is he bullshitting me?
No, that's my real name.
It really is Chris. Well, I will never forget now, seeing in public I've forgotten your name. But that was just a little bit of play acting.
But you, let's get a little blunt talk now, just so that we make sure that we cover.
That wasn't blunt enough?
That was very blunt. That was literal blunt talk.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about figurative blunt talk. Walter
let's
Blunt.
Talk about Emma Blunt.
Let's talk about Emma Blunt. It's a God, you know, there's so many other. Okay, we'll get to blunt talk in a second. You said something earlier that just sparked a thought, and I'm curious to know what you think about it, because it's something that affects a lot of people. You said you lost your hair at 19,
mm-hmm.
and you thought your life was over.
Oh.
And then you realized when did you realize that, because it's something that affects a lot, like 85% of guys will lose their hair at some point in their life, you know?
But at some point, is not 19.
So
55 is not 19. You know, 55, your life is over. It's finished. You have no more expectations at 55. I know that. I'm 75. And, you know, 20 years I've been a kind of no man's land, a wilderness of nothingness. And but I might have been, no, seriously, I might have been had I not lost my hair when I was 19, because I got all that shit behind me. I did all the stuff, the comb over and wearing hats all the time. I had a hairpiece. I didn't wear it, you know, every day. But I did have a hairpiece for acting. And I discovered early on, because I'm a fairly pragmatic person, that if I was going up, because I was, my first 5 years of my life were working in regional theater. And there they would employ you for an entire season. 48 weeks, 50 wow. weeks. And so I would go to the audition wearing my hairpiece. And it was a really beautiful hairpiece. And they usually ask you to do two pieces, you know, a comedy piece and a tragic piece, a Shakespeare and Oscar Wilde, something like that. And when I'd done the first piece, I would start to tell them what my second piece was going to be. And as I was doing it, I used to do this. And take the piece off and put it on the floor beside me and do my second piece. And usually I'd find people going. And sorry, I was, of course, we're on a microphone. I was just doing like dumb, stupid.
Mouth agape. Yeah.
I was selling myself as two actors for the price of one.
It's genius.
So this is the guy you walked in.
Oh, he's good. I believed he had hair.
You quite like. You know, he was good. But now, here's another guy. Think what you can do.
How many places you could put that guy.
Exactly.
But how did you get around? Because obviously, people put a lot of their identity into their, like, oh, that's part of, you know, so how did you get past that? And how did you finally go, you know what, it's fine? Because I'll tell you, I think Picard was one of the first characters. I mean, I know there was Kojak in the 70s, but Picard, I think, was one of the first guys where it was like, you know, it's pretty fucking cool to be bald. Like, it's pretty cool to have your head shaved. I mean, it's kind of cool. You made that okay.
One evening, there's an area in London, in East London, called the Barbican. It's an area that was developed, high-rise buildings and affordable housing in the 70s. It's all concrete. It was a brilliant idea, and the Barbican Theatre is there. But it's a bit bleak. It's a bit featureless. I was walking across the main plaza, and it was pouring with rain. You know, that kind of horizontal rain
yes.
that you get in London. And I passed this guy who had an umbrella and a hat on, and he was scuttling along under the umbrella. We passed one another a few seconds, and I heard my name called out, and I turned around. The guy with the umbrella yelled out, he lifted up the umbrella, and he said, thank you for everything you've done for us, and took off his hat, and he was bald. And it was almost like a set-up moment, you know. And I said, you're very welcome. But it was horrible. It was horrible for a few years. And then I saved up my money, and I realized I could afford to buy really good hair pieces and different kinds of ones. So I would have things I could style. So if I was doing 15 plays in a season, I had this very inexpensive, from the company's point of view, way of transforming myself into somebody else. So I could play juveniles, and then I could play, you know, 88-year-old butlers who have family retainers, that kind of thing.
So it really was about the chameleon aspect of being able to disappear into your work that helped you go, oh, this is actually an asset.
No, it was economics.
Okay.
No, I mean, and directors got it very quickly. Oh, I see what's going on here. Yes. Oh, we like you. You're an okay actor, but I see how I can use you with, you know, that feature. I guess I was... I mean, I kind of feel that it was Star Trek time when I fully felt, screw it. I'm fine. I don't need to cover up. But my last audition, the studio, Paramount, had me do my last audition wearing a hairpiece.
Really?
This is not much known. It's a little known, but not much. And so I did my audition and went back into the other room, and they'd brought a hairdresser in to put it on, and she was taking it off when, and this audition had been for the studio, the TV heads of studio, and they all came into the room to say, thank you very much for coming, it was very good of you, and the hairdresser, who became Joy Zapata is her name, she worked on our show for years and years, brilliant, wonderful woman, a great hairdresser, she said, you know why they came in? They wanted to see you without the hairpiece. And the hairpiece never showed up again.
Oh, wow.
It's like the French accent. Mm. Before we recorded the first series, Gene Roddenberry said to me, you know, this is a Frenchman, Jean-Luc Picard. I wonder if maybe you should do it with a French accent. I've kind of had that idea in my head. He said, why don't we just put something on tape, see what it sounds like? So I recorded, and it must be somewhere in the vaults of Paramount. I recorded the opening voiceover with a French accent. And very quickly, everybody realized that actually I sounded like Peter Sellers.
Do you happen to remember how that went?
Inspector Clouseau. and it was a disastrous idea. Space. The final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. You know? I mean, well,
the starship, what?
Look at you. I mean, it wouldn't have worked. No, who would have taken me seriously? Mr. Crusher?
Ah, Beverly.
Yeah.
Ah, bon.
Engagé.
Engagé.
Yeah. God, it's, I don't know, Patrick. I feel like maybe not. French. I don't. That'd be amazing. Just one episode.
Just imagine if I'd been French with a hairpiece.
It's like, a completely different show.
It would have been Clouseau.
It would have been Clouseau. Well, Will inherited Riker's beard.
He did, didn't he? But only after the show was over.
Only after the
he
show
couldn't
was
have
over.
Grown a beard.
No,
in the
no.
First seasons.
Peach fuzz. But Blunt Talk. As I said, I saw the first episode. And you're really funny in it, and it's great, and there's a lot of really great actors in it, too. And it's – I don't want to give too much away, but essentially your character is so sweet but super fucked up and trying to barely – he seems indestructible, but it feels like the edges on him are fraying a bit.
Oh, very much so. He is coming apart at the beginning of – our series, and he's fighting to keep his show together. The numbers are not great. He's threatened. His job is threatened. But he believes passionately in what he does. He believes in the power of journalism, and he believes in the power of television to do good. and to change the world, and most particularly to change America.
Yeah.
That's what he wants. He loves America, as I do. But he sees that maybe some little adjustments here and there in attitude might help. And he wants to bring that change about here in the United States. But he is struggling in his private life, which is chaotic.
Yeah, he goes through about every drug you could possibly go through.
There are more. No, he is not an, the impression being given is that he is an addict and he is complete wreck and he's not. I mean, he's doing a brilliant show as best he can. But he is feeling vulnerable and lonely. He's on his fourth divorce and kind of unloved. And so he's finding solace in illegal substances and plus alcohol.
And that too, yeah, just to round it out.
But it's not all about that.
No.
That's what people are connecting with.
Because that's just the, you know, like, that's just part of the setup in the first episode. And when a series is new, people see the first couple episodes, but obviously that's not.
Yeah, and there are whole episodes where nothing like that happens at all.
Yeah.
Nothing.
But they have to sort of paint a picture a little bit.
Yeah, and it's quite a vivid picture from the very beginning. And what I love is that everybody has been brave enough. Jonathan Ames, who is our brilliant senior writer, executive producer, showrunner.
He
Bored to Death. It was wonderful. And he created substance for us. Substance in each one of the principal characters. They're all very distinguishable, quite charismatic and quite idiosyncratic. And we have episodes in which quite serious matters are discussed and faced, dealt with. The wonderful Jackie Weaver, who has a husband who has Alzheimer's and he disappears. And and Jackie, we go looking for him. It has got so many elements in it. And looking at all 10 episodes of the first season, they're like 10 little plays. And I think our audiences will be comfortable with that, in that we're not repeating routines or certain setups that will be anticipated and expected.
Yeah, it's not a madcap comedy. It's a character-driven comedy.
Very much so, but it's wacky.
Yeah. Do you push some of that? Do you like, I think we can make this a little sillier.
Yeah. You only watched the first episode.
I saw the first episode. Yeah, I got...
So you didn't see the big bathroom scene?
I saw the first episode and a half. I got the discs last night.
Okay.
And I saw the first episode and a half this morning before I came into work.
Well, just as you turned off the second episode, you were about to see the bathroom scene. I urge you when you go home to
All right.
Pour yourself a glass or something. or maybe you're a teetotaler.
I'm a teetotaler.
You are?
I am.
Man. Well,
Tea, then.
Yeah. I don't know what to say to that.
By the way, I didn't turn it off because I wasn't enjoying it. I turned it off because I had to get to work.
Of course.
I want you to know that. Absolutely. I want to make that distinction. Because my friend Brett Gelman's on the show, too. It's the guy, he's the producer that lives on the other side of, he's the neighbor with the beard.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Brett,
yeah.
He's wonderful. He's
one of the funniest people.
He's wonderful. And he comes back. We have a big party in episode 9. And all the people we loved having are come to the party, get invited. And I don't want people to think that those who are not at the party, we didn't like, on the contrary.
Of course.
We just couldn't have everybody. But there is a scene with Walter in a bathroom, in an airport bathroom, that I'd urge
all right
to watch.
Well, the painting scene was pretty remarkable.
It's like something out of the Renaissance. The great thing about Jonathan Ames is that he has an amazing vocabulary, but he uses it in an unusual way. So phrases and words crop up that are a little uncommon, and it gives a lot of charm to the way people express themselves in a very personal and idiosyncratic way. There's not a line that any of us spoke that was a dull line. They just didn't exist. Every episode, every scene, every speech, we each of us had something interesting to say, or rather something ordinary to say, but it was said in an interesting way.
Right.
And we all appreciated that so much.
I mean, it must be nice when you feel like, I don't really have to do anything. I just don't have to. The writing is good. As long as I don't get in the way of that and just let the writing do its work.
You are so right. Getting out of the way of, taking performance out of the way of beautiful writing, great situations, nice conflicts, and incredibly talented people. Our permanent core group are so extraordinary. They're wonderful actors, and they're all wonderful comedians, too. They're comic actors, improvisers, stand-up, and some of our guests, too. I mean, our intermittent therapist, the Freudian psychiatrist, is played by Richard
Lewis.
Lewis. And
who is a great character for a psychiatrist.
Oh, I think every psychiatrist in the future is going to have to be based on Richard. He is perfect, but he has some very unorthodox ideas.
Yes, but a lovely guy in real life. Richard's a lovely guy.
Terrific.
Well, this was really wonderful. And, you know, I just appreciate on behalf of people who are fans of you that you're so willing to screw around and have fun, and you on Extras was incredible, by the way, but the fact that you are willing to do that kind of stuff when you don't have to, you know.
One of the best days work in my life was the shooting the trailer scene with Ricky, and because I was such a huge fan from watching The Office, and he is awesome, except that on the set he's a nightmare because he laughs all the time.
And his laugh really seems to cut through everything.
Oh, totally. I mean, you can't use it in any way. I said, what is it? Why is it? He said, it's the letter K. And then he laughed. It's K. It's like, he said, when you say knickers, and I said, but the K is silent. He said, that's exactly what I mean. That's why it's so funny. Man, that's a curious sense of humor. But that was a wonderful experience. And yeah, I think that was the first time I saw that there was a potential in taking the public perception of who Patrick Stewart might be, which is largely based on two roles, Jean-Luc Picard and Charles Xavier. And you know, things that I've done, you know, chat shows and all of that. As a rather upright, serious, caring, compassionate man of the world. And as Extra showed, Patrick Stewart might just possibly be somebody very different. Because I'm not Jean-Luc Picard. I'm not Charles Xavier. Oh, Lord. I mean, it would be great to be as smart as they are, and I'm not. But I wouldn't like to be them. So this perception is kind of what we start with. It's certainly what Seth started with on American Dad.
Right.
Because I didn't know he was going to do this, and nobody told me. He drew my character so that he looked like me.
Right.
It's unmistakably Patrick Stewart.
Absolutely.
But doing these shocking, outrageous things.
Your accent makes it okay. Your accent makes it all okay.
You know, Roman Imalco has this great line in the first episode. You'll have heard it. When he says, no, your frontal lobes are shot. You're a mess. All you've got left is your accent. And that's another one. We have Roman Imalco.
Roman Imalco's great.
Playing the head of the network. And it's thrilling to have these people. We had Elizabeth Shue on the show.
Yeah. Ed Begley Jr.'s on the show.
Ed Begley Jr. plays Rosalie's husband, who's kind of, he's got problems. And he's wonderful and brings such quiet seriousness and dignity to the show. I'm going to sneeze, but maybe I'm not. Maybe it went away.
Think of a grapefruit. Think of a grapefruit.
Really?
Think of biting into a grapefruit.
Wow. It's working.
I'm a wizard of sneezes.
It's working. It's like the mother of a girlfriend of mine, when I was very young, when I was 19, 20, told her that if whenever she felt sexually aroused,
oh no,
she should think of rusty bicycles.
What? and a porn star.
I remember saying to her, well, clearly it doesn't work, does it? You know, but what a strange thing to say.
It's so strange. You
know, where I would love to say, Mrs. X, where did that notion come from?
Was Dr. Xavier's wife?
Might have been. Well, anyway, it's... I recommend it. I recommend you watch at least the second half of episode 2.
I absolutely am going to watch it because I have the discs now.
And I hope that people will take to it.
And if you're aroused during the performance of Blunt Talk, think of a rusty bicycle.
You know, that's a line we could use in that show.
You totally should.
I could say that to Celia. Listen, Celia, when you feel an overwhelming urge to have sex with somebody, I've got the answer to that. Rusty bicycles.
But it starts having the opposite effect because she's making an association between this. So whenever she's a bicycle, she gets really turned on.
Yeah, I know.
And then there's got to be the Tour de France, and it's like, oh no.
Oh yeah. Those skinny guys.
Yeah.
With their shaved legs.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hot.
All those sinewy bicyclists.
Oh. It's like little wet seals.
Yes.
Pedaling around.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, this has been lovely,
it's
Chris.
It's wonderful. You remember.
Oh, yes. I knew all along.
You sly dog.
Just a little technique I use.
Well, you know, Will has...
Will
Wheaton, as long as I've known him, has always said... Patrick is the loveliest. He's one of the most wonderful. Like, he adores you. And I really understand why. I mean, you were so gracious, and thank you so much for having fun with us and screwing around. And I hope everyone watches Blunt Talk. Did you say August 22nd on Stars?
Saturday night, 9:00.
On Stars.
Be there. Yeah.
Rusty bicycle. We end the podcast by telling people to enjoy their... We say, enjoy your burrito. It's just a way that we sign off the podcast. But I feel like since you're here and you have a far superior voice, would you sign us off?
Okay. Do I need to use that phrase?
Well, it is the... Listen, I'm not going to tell you what you can and can't do. It is the phrase that we normally sign off with. But if you want to come up with a new one, you can do whatever you want.
I'll go with the theme.
Okay.
Of your signing off.
Please.
But I'm going to use a different... Mexican food.
Okay.
Dish.
Okay.
Because my wife claims that my pronunciation of this word is inauthentic.
Okay.
I know it's not.
Okay.
My Spanish is, in pronunciation, is outstanding.
Es bueno.
However, it is Castilian.
Oh. That's very highbrow.
Yeah. And not,
of course it would be.
Not Central American Spanish at all. But I would say... thank you, everyone, for listening to me, Patrick Stewart, on this podcast. Enjoy your taco.
That was almost Canadian.
It was?
Taco.
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 What would you say? Taco.
Taco.
No.
What?
The Spanish do not say taco.
I've been a fool for so long.
Taco.
Taco.
There you go.
All right, now do the Star Trek opening, but with that accent.
Wonderful. You know what I'm called, of course. It's delightful whenever I hear it. I love it so much. I don't mean in any way to be mean about this, but that when Spanish speakers talk about X-Men, of course, it is X-Men.
X-Men, yeah.
Yeah. I love the X-Men.
X-Men. Dr. X.
And it's so charming.
Aww. Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Hey, listeners, it's Will Arnett. Our podcast, Smartless, has crossed a milestone that seemed unfathomable when we started nearly 4 years ago, as we've just released our 200th episode. Join us as we welcome the dynamic duo of hilarity, Steve Martin and Martin Short. You've seen them on screen together in The Three Amigos, Father of the Bride 1 and 2, and most recently, and only Murders in the Building. Both are comedic geniuses in their own right, but together they are always electric. And this episode of Smartless is no exception. I don't know if I've laughed more in a single episode than this one. We discuss their career arcs both separately and as a comedy team, how they met, who is more difficult to work with, and what motivates them today. Is Steve a better banjo player than Marty as a singer? Find out on this bye. centennial episode of Smartless. Follow Smartless on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Smartless ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Plus, you get to hear Sean cry. What a loser!